I'm Ira Flatow, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. We're going to be talking about the new science of nutrigenomics.
He requested something called wheat germ, organic honey, and tiger's milk.
Oh, yes, those are the charm substances that some years ago were felt to contain life-preserving properties.
You mean there was no deep fat? No steak or cream pies or hot fudge?
Those were thought to be unhealthy. Precisely the opposite of what we now know to be true.
Incredible.
That, of course, is a little bit of the movie Sleeper, where in Woody Allen's film, a cryogenetically preserved health food owner wakes up in the year 2173 to find out that everything he thought that he knew about nutrition was false. Of course, in that movie it says, well, you should have been eating all this fat and all this stuff because it was really good for you. We didn't know that back 170 years ago. Well, scientists now have another 170 years which to prove Woody Allen right or wrong, and those involved in a new branch of genomic research are attempting to do just that. It's called nutritional genomics, and it's already changing the way that some people eat. There are companies, for example, that ask you to swab the inside of your cheek with a piece of cotton and then send them that sample cotton back to them, and they will analyze the DNA in your cheek cells and send you a diet plan and suggestion about dietary supplements, which they happen to sell, all tailor-made to your genetic profile. So they analyze the genes in that little piece of cheek cell there, and they can tell you what's the right kinds of food for your gene type and the kinds of genes that you have. Is this the future of nutrition? Maybe it's just a fad, or is there real value to the health of consumers here? Joining me to talk about the science and business of nutrigenomics are Raymond Rodriguez. He's professor of molecular and cellular biology at the University of California, Davis, and director of the University Center of Excellence in Nutritional Genomics. He joins us from the campus of UC Davis. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Ira.
You're welcome. Jim Caput is senior molecular biologist at the Center of Excellence in Nutritional Genomics at UC Davis. He's the founder, president, and chief scientific officer of nutrigenomics. That's a nutritional genomics company based in Chicago, and he joins us today from WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ira. I'm pleased to be here.
Thank you. Also with us is Marion Nessel, a professor and chair of the Department of Nutrition and Food Studies at NYU and the author of Food Politics and Safe Food, both published by University of California Press. She's still with us here.
I'm still here.
She's still here. give us an idea, Jim. What type of was I correct in saying that this is where things are headed now? Or are you able to take someone's genetic profile and say, hey, this food is better for you to eat and this one is not?
I certainly believe that that's where we're headed. I don't think we're there now. We have a few single gene defects like PKU, and every baby born in the United States is tested for PKU. And if you have that mutation, then you're not supposed to eat phenylalanine. But what these other companies are trying to do, or purportedly trying to do, is to tell you things of what to eat based on a limited genetic information for things like chronic diseases or nutritional supplements. And we don't have enough science, in my view, to actually do that right now.
Ray, what do you say?
Well, I agree with Jim. I think the field is in the process of emerging. But, you know, I was just thinking about the question that your assistant asked me at the beginning of the show, what did I have for lunch? And like others probably didn't, I didn't have lunch yet, but I did have breakfast. And what I had for breakfast was 24 grams of hydrolyzed whey protein in 8 ounces of orange juice, followed by a multivitamin containing 300 milligrams of lycopene, 81 milligrams of aspirin, and 250 milligrams of vitamin C. And I should mention that 250 milligrams of vitamin C is 416 times more vitamin C than I need to prevent scurvy. So might ask, what am I doing here?
Okay.
You know, I'm making an educated guess. I'm taking a hunch based on science. I think except for the aspirin, there's probably no direct proof that any of these constituents or their amounts actually will benefit my health. But I'm sort of making a guess. Mm-hmm. About what's good for me.
So, so you're saying then if, by looking at your gene profile, then you can make not just a guess, you can make a more factual
Exactly. And prediction, I think that's where we're headed. We want to know what are the facts behind those? Am I close when I'm guessing? Am I really off? You know, is there an enzyme, a gene that codes for an enzyme in my body that doesn't utilize some of these components? So I'm just basically excreting them. So I think that's what nutritional genomics is trying to do, is trying to create a better match between the common foods that we eat and our ability to utilize those foods. Are we using them? Are we using only 50% of the total benefits of these foods because we're carrying various genetic variants in our genes? Can we increase that so we can get 90% efficiency from the foods that we eat?
1-800-989-8255 is our number. It sounds very much like what the drug companies are trying to do to find out, to tailor make drugs to fit your genetic profile, so that we don't waste all these drugs. You go from one drug to another. This works, this doesn't. It's like hit and miss now. It sounds like very much the same thing that you're doing with food here.
Yes, that field's called pharmacogenomics, and it's been around for probably 10 years now. And basically, nutritional genomics is sort of an offshoot of pharmacogenomics. It's sort of looking at the dietary components of foods, the complex chemicals in foods, sort of as medicines or drugs. And you know, the pharmacogenomicists found that certain drugs had low efficiency or efficacy in certain populations, so they'd put them back on the shelf, only to realize that they were dealing with a mixed group of individuals, and it was actually benefiting some, and it was not benefiting others, and it was actually harming other groups. So now the trend is to go back and stratify those populations, and genotype them, and see how the drug interacts with the particular genotype of this strata. And we want to do the same thing with food.
Mary Nissel, what's wrong with this idea?
Oh, I'm in favor of basic research. So in theory, I think it's a great idea, and it would be wonderful if everybody had the wherewithal to find out what their genetic makeup was and what they should eat to do that. But, you know, if we look at the main public health nutrition problems in this country, particularly, and now throughout the world, of course, it's overweight, eating too many calories and too much of everything for our ability to metabolize it. And, you know, the way to fix this is behavioral. It's to eat less and to move more. And it's hard for me to believe that, except in a few people, finding out more information about genetics is going to help. Of course, the other problem is that it lends itself immediately to quackery, as you've already, it's just a very thin line between serious research and jumping the research and taking it further. I'm thinking of the blood type diet, for example, which purports to advise people what to eat based on what their blood type is.
Let me add one thing, though, Marian. Even if every person were to eat well, and we know what to eat, so that's clear, what you've said is true. If you go through the scientific literature, almost every chronic disease that we know of, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cancer, all have about 10% of the people who get that are going to get that disease simply because of their genetics.
Right.
Now, of course, it interacts with the environment.
I'd say 5 to 10, but okay,
5 to 10. So whatever the number is. So even if everybody ate well, we still have a substantial proportion of our population who are going to be susceptible to these diseases. And we're not saying that food is going to solve all of the 5 or 10%, but if we can understand how food works with the genes to produce the chronic diseases for the people who are overweight now, who are eating bad, that may also help us understand how to help the people who are genetically predisposed, and even if they had the perfect diet, they're still going to have the disease. You know, so this basic information is valuable.
Yeah, I would agree, again, in theory. But one of the things that surprised me was the breakfast, because it wasn't food. It was pills. I'm a foodie. I mean, I'm one of these people who lives to eat. And my idea of not fun is taking pills in the morning. So I want to hear more about food in this.
Marian, I'll assure you, I'll have a lunch as soon as I leave the studio.
But the idea that if you could distill what's in broccoli and not have to eat it, or people who hate broccoli or Brussels sprouts or asparagus, these kinds of green things that some people don't like, and then take a pill for it. That's an incredible marketing tool, is it not?
As I said, one step towards quackery and marketing. I'm glad you threw that in. There's a lot of money in this.
Yeah, and the problem is that you can do that distillation and packaging and selling, but you don't know how much of that to eat, and that's a very big issue, even mm-hmm. in today's society with dietary supplements or with all of these chemicals that you can take off the shelves. And as Marion's pointing out, we don't have to go to a pill-based food source. I mean, I certainly don't want to do that, but to tweak my food intake based on my genes so that I can be healthier, that I like. I think that might be helpful. I think that's what Ray's doing, by the way, because I think quite well.
Ira, I think the point is we've reached a point in our scientific knowledge about the structure of the human genome that we can actually start asking these questions. We couldn't do this just mm-hmm. 10 years ago, you know, and I think that our Center of Excellence for Nutritional Genomics wants to look at the genetic variants and how that genetic variation interacts with our nutritional environment.
A really tiny variance, isn't it?
I'm just going to give you some statistics on type 2 diabetes. You know, the frequency in the white population in the U.S. is 7%. For African Americans, it's 10%. For Mexican Americans, it's 14%. For mm-hmm. Pacific Islanders, Asian Americans, it's 15. Native Americans, it's 37. And for the Pima Indian alone, it's 50%. Wow. Now, as a molecular biologist and a geneticist, I see a genetic component here. And what we'd like to do is sort of try to focus on these areas of health disparities, especially in these populations that are showing such a high degree, high frequency, and early onset and severity of these diseases, to see if we can tease out the social, behavioral, economic factors from the genetic factors, and then propose a diet that makes sense and reduces some of the rates of just type 2 diabetes alone.
And my guess is that diet is going to involve eating less and moving more.
No, absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's also true that our diets, I've started reading your book, Marion, and I'm very fascinated by it. And I keep thinking, because I get into conversations a lot, do we really want to go back to a agrarian society where we have to worry about spoilage and food distribution and that issue, which is there now? And so the production that we can do of foods is great. It's just that we have been doing an experiment, and we haven't known exactly how to put these food chemicals together for each genotype. And I think down the road we'll be able to do that.
Experiment, are you talking about processed foods? Is that the experiment you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, essentially in this century, we've moved from, you know, growing our own foods into this mass production of food chemicals and then reassembling them and selling them. I mean, this is a good market. And it gives us good nutrition, maybe too good of nutrition.
It gives us calories.
It's calories, yeah. And we put together the combination slightly inappropriately for our genotype. And I think that's what Ray is saying with these health disparities. The Pima Indians probably wouldn't have these issues if they were back on the diets that they evolved with during evolution.
So is the first efforts going to be to help people get over illnesses, the kinds of illnesses that you were talking about, diabetes there, or is it going to find the optimal food that healthy people should be eating?
Well, I think
if I'm a company who's going to be making these things, these supplements, I'm not going to waste time with the sick people. I'm going to waste time with the bulk of people who are healthy and sell them the stuff over the internet.
Yeah. The interesting thing about this field and most of the new technologies is they're being embraced by affluent, highly educated consumers who are willing to spend a little bit of money to achieve optimal health, mm-hmm. to maximize performance, to delay the onset of age-related and chronic diseases. So these are the people who are most interested in this, and I think there's about 30% of the market fall into this category. They would be consumers of nutritional genomic services. Now you have to think, what happens to the other 70%, people who only have a high school degree, don't understand genomics, who only make $50,000 or $40,000 a year? So is this going to be a science and a benefit for the elite, or can we develop mm-hmm. a model that we can affect everybody? And I should mention that, you know, Marion's comment about eating less and exercising more is absolutely correct. But, you know, if you look at the statistics that I just gave you from whites to Pima Indian, what you can do, you can extrapolate in a very culturally insensitive way that white people eat less and exercise more, and Pima Indians are overweight couch potatoes. So I think that those are excellent recommendations, but we have to recognize what we're seeing here in these really very dramatic statistics is there's some factor. I don't believe it's just that the Native Americans are overweight couch potatoes compared to white Americans, that there's probably a genetic component. And I think that there are a number of laboratories that are starting to identify candidate genes. You know, the problem with type 2 diabetes is related to obesity, and that's a very complex trait, probably 300 genes at least and markers involved. So it's going to take some time, but I think the genomic approach, looking at individual genetic variation and how that relates to food, is probably going to be the way we're going to crack this problem of chronic diseases.
All right. I got to jump in and remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Ray, any comment?
Well, I was just I don't want to monopolize the conversation here.
Well, let me ask Jim to get a Jim.
Yeah. Well, I agree with Ray, and let's get back to this thing about treating the wealthy, the affluent, that this science is only for those of us who can afford it. And I have to admit that right now that's probably true, but my view is, being very pragmatic about it, we have to drive the science some way, either through NIH, which typically hadn't funded very much work in nutrition or nutritional genomics for sure in the last 10 years. That's now changing dramatically. And also food companies have to get involved in terms of funding the type of work that can generate the science that we need to go forward. My view, though, is that if we can find out how to make people healthier, we can readjust our spending in our society so that we can start treating the problems of malnutrition, which are rampant around the world, and I don't have all the statistics at the top of my tongue, but what we need to do is just improve everybody's health, and it's not going to be just trickle down. It's going to be attacking the chronic problems, which, as Ray has just pointed out, go from the white population through Pima Indians. The only other thing I'd like to add is that we're not promising in the field, or at least the scientists that I know that do nutritional genomics are not promising magic bullet pills where we pop three pills and we're not going to get type 2 diabetes. These are very complex diseases that have multiple genes, as Ray was pointing out, and multiple environmental factors. And it's going to be really understanding your genomic information and adapting to the right diet and then maybe taking a couple pills to tweak. So I don't think we're going to move to a place where pills were going to be three times a day.
All right, we're going to take it. Let me just jump in here because I know we have lots more to talk about, and I don't want to get anybody started because we have a break coming up in just a half a minute. So let me go to the break and come back and talk lots more with Jim Caput, Mary Nessel, and Raymond Rodriguez. We're talking about this very interesting new science of nutrigenomics. We'll take your calls. Lots of you, since we're talking about nutrition and health in the same breath, a lot of people would like to talk about it. So stay on the line. We'll get right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A brief program note, join Neil Conan and his guests on Monday in this hour for a discussion of the future of the Endangered Species Act. We're talking today about nutrigenomics with my guests, Marion Nessel, professor and chair of the Department of Nutrition and Food Studies at NYU in New York and author of Food Politics and Safe Food, both published by University of California Press. Raymond Rodriguez, professor of molecular and cellular biology at the University of California, Davis, and director of the University Center of Excellence in Nutritional Genomics. And Jim Caput, senior molecular biologist at the Center of Excellence in Nutritional Genomics at UC Davis and founder, president, and chief scientific officer of Nutrigenomics, a nutritional genomics company based in Chicago. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Lots of people want to get on. Isaac in New York. Hi, Isaac.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
Well, I had a question for your guest, Ira, about autoimmune problems related to food. I've just been reading some things lately that tended to say that a lot of people have problems with foods that they are allergic to, have very minor allergies too, but it can be very common things like corn and wheat and rye, all sorts of grains, but also vegetables. And it seems that those allergies are created through sort of random, it's called transpositions inside of genes in your lymph nodes that create all these antibodies by sort of slicing and dicing and mixing up parts of the genome. And it doesn't seem to me like you could really find that sort of thing out from sampling cheek cells. I was just wondering what your guests had to say about immunities and how.
How are you going to test? Ken, good question. Ray or Jim, can you test for allergies and things like that from the DNA sampling?
Ray, you want to start that or you want me to?
Well, at this point, I don't think so, but I'm not absolutely sure. But there are a lot of very efficient and effective tests for food allergens. And your
those
allergists
big scratch tests and things
yep,
like that.
Yep.
So there's two issues here. One is that an allergic reaction with the food, a lot of people have that. Now, on top of that, there could be certain chemicals in the food which, because they act on your promoters involved in immune function, could amplify the signal, the regulation of the genes involved in creating the immune response. Alternatively, we might be able to find foods, naturally occurring foods, that would have the right combination of naturally occurring chemicals that would reduce your immune response and therefore perhaps get over a little of the immune problems that happen. So there are really two separate issues here. Most of the time when you're talking about an allergic reaction, it's just the normal immune system. It has very little to do with the science of nutritional genomics. Mm-hmm. It would be like if you have a hyper response to dust particles or to, cockroaches. Mm-hmm. I have an allergic response to cockroaches because mm-hmm. I lived in New York for a while. So there's two separate issues there. But nutritional genomics might impact that in mm-hmm. certain ways.
Marion?
Yeah, this is a political issue because the government funds so little research on food allergies. It's one of the most neglected branches of nutrition science that I can imagine. And it seems to me that if genomics is a handle into getting into food allergies, I'd use it.
Yeah, just to get a little leverage in there. 1-800-999-8255. But aren't we now, Mary, aren't we talking now and at this early stage that I hear Ray and Jim talking about creating a pill that would take the replace of food now and instead of telling us to eat better? Is that too hard to just tell us how to, willpower or something like that, eat the right diet?
Well, it's the standard reductionist approach that's always used, is let's reduce this down to one nutrient, one pill, one something. I mean, what fascinates me is the funding issue, because if 5 to 10% of these kinds of problems are due to genetics, that means that 90 to 95% are due to behavior or environmental issues, and yet there's very, very little money going into studying behavior. Now, mind you, studying behavior is difficult. It's really hard to do. Humans make terrible experimental subjects. But it seems to me that we know enough about nutrition and health to know that a huge percentage of the difficulties that we're having with type 2 diabetes especially have to do with behavioral and environmental components, and we ought to be looking at those.
There's no doubt, I agree with you, that there are some scientists out there who also say, though, that the drive to eat is genetically programmed, and therefore, if the food's available, we're going to go out and eat it. So that's, I think, the whole message that I like to propose on nutritional genomics, is that it's an interaction always. It's not one or the other, but it has to do with what you're born with, your genes that you're born with, and then the environment that you're placed in. We're in a social environment, which, food's everywhere, and we're also in a place where the food content is very rich in calories and a little bit too much fat, maybe it's too much carbohydrate. All of those in combination, those interactions, cause this type of problem.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the phones. Teresa in California. Hi, Teresa.
Hi there. Thanks for a great show. I have multiple sclerosis, as do about 2.5 million people around the world and almost 400,000 in the United States. Some of the recent research seems to indicate that this is a chromosomal defect, but for years there have been questions about whether or not it's an environmental virus or allergen or whatnot. And the therapy that I'm finding effective is actually something that enables me to digest protein. It's called Prokarin, P-R-O-K-A-R-I-N. And the theory behind it is that people with MS like myself cannot adequately digest the protein, and so then we have an autoimmune attack because of this. I was wondering if your panelists have any research on MS or any of this protein and digestive issues. I know that the MS Society says that 200 Americans a week are being diagnosed with MS, so this is really
So you're saying that it could be a secondary disease to some other kind of inability to process the protein, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't know, but we have biologists here, not physicians. So I'll go out. Well, it's an interesting.
I always say more research needed, and this is a political issue because the amount of research that's going into these kinds of questions is extremely small. It's just not identified as a high priority. It's much easier to fund something that's looking at molecular approaches than these complicated interactions between behavior and the environment.
But even in the field of science, of genetic science, it's very rare to have people actually have diet or nutrition or dietary chemicals as a variable in the experiment. And therefore, we're really what I use the term genome-centric, which is, look, we've come a very far way with that approach. But now when we get to the complicated diseases, we have to start putting in the interactions.
This
both
would
with
seem
the nutrition.
Like a perfect case for what you're doing, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Finding those the little changes in the genes between what, you know, Teresa's MS and people don't have it and see how that interacts with protein
Absolutely.
Production.
Comparison to me is the way to do the science nowadays. And if you just do one individual or one population or one laboratory animal or one cell strain, I don't really think you're getting the type of science that's going to be applicable quickly to the human population.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to add to Marion, I agree with you, by the way. Social issues are critical to this whole thing, too.
Teresa, do you have a...
Oh, yes, just very quickly. I think that Dr. Nessel has made an excellent point with the political aspects of all of this medical research. People in my position are immediately told by their neurologist to go on very specific drugs that suppress the immune system. And most of the research, if you look at the foreign research in particular, it shows that the drugs do not work. And again, I do think that because of the amount of money to be made from sick people like myself, there's a tremendous amount of bias.
All right,
thank you.
Thanks for calling, and have a good new year. We're talking about nutrigenomics this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let me go backwards a little and go to Emily in Oregon, not because Emily is backwards, of course, but she has a question. Hi, Emily.
Hi. How's it going?
Hi. How's it going?
Pretty good. My question is, for the people who are actually doing the nutrigenomics now, can you tell me a little more about the details of what are the genetic tests that are done? What are the things that you look for? And then how does that determine what sorts of things you recommend? Because I know my daughter has a genetic translocation. We know a lot about her genetic makeup, you know, where the genes are, but that tells us almost nothing because it's really rare and we really don't know anything now that we know what her genes look like.
Yeah, what's the practical side and how do you use it?
Ray,
you want to?
Okay. Hasn't talked for a while. Both of us can handle this one.
The point is that we alluded to this earlier. This is going to be a long and a complex process because now what we're faced with what we're calling chronic diseases. We're not talking primarily about the monogenic disease. It's a single gene traits like PKU and galactosemia and that sort of thing. We're talking about diseases like asthma, cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes, and there are going to be hundreds if not thousands of genes and genetic variations that are going to be involved in producing these. So the analysis is going to be a long and coming, and I think it's going to be a very complicated one. And I just wanted to say that one of the things we haven't talked about is the impact of computer science and information technology in this whole business. Now that we've moved away from the monogenic Mendelian-type genes to these very complex diseases, we're going to need a very sophisticated, high-speed, high-capacity computation of genetic information to analyze these.
Ray, let me jump in and ask where the funding for most of this frontier work is coming from now.
Well, I think right now most of it is coming from the National Institute of Health. I think that people at NIH, policymakers there, and people on the Hill realize that there's a growing epidemic of obesity in the United States. Since in the last 10 years, obesity, clinical obesity, has gone from 10 to 14% nationwide to almost 25%. Now, being obese may make you feel uncomfortable in your clothing, but the long-term effects is that obesity will be followed by a whole range of chronic diseases. Type 2, we've talked about that quite a bit. Type 2 diabetes is one. You know, and every year we spend $100 billion on diagnosing and treating type 2 diabetes. So I think Congress and the NIH have realized that nutrition, health, and obesity has to be a focus in the future.
Well, the government always gets in at the ground level, and then the companies, like, for example, the pharmaceuticals industry, jumps in, makes the products, and gets the big profits from these things. Where are we in that cycle here? Are we still in a basic level of the government funding? When are we going to see the, you know, the guys who want to sell us to the public jumping in on these things?
Well, I'll let Jim address that issue, but I think that we're very early on. We're still in the research, the discovery phase. Companies like GEMS and other companies are probably what you would call in the R&D phase.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mary, did you want to say something?
Well, I mean, here again, there's such a strong behavioral component in this. And what the government is doing on the behavior of obesity is telling everybody to be more active. Nobody is saying anything about eating less, which is absolutely essential, because they can't. It's too politically impossible. If you say eat less, you have to tell people what to eat less of. And there you're going to be talking about specific food products that are high in fat and high in sugars and high in calories.
Mm-hmm. So what's going to happen?
There's tremendous political opposition to any kind of eat less message.
Jim?
What I think we need is an international genome project in scope that's equivalent to what we had for the Human Genome Project. Otherwise, this is going to dribble out over the next 5 or 6 years, maybe a little bit longer, depending on the funding levels. And we will get information, and actually pharmaceuticals are producing drugs right now, not necessarily based only on nutritional genomics, but anti-obesity drugs, anti-diabetic drugs, things which interact because of the diet interacting. So this is starting to happen already, and the problem is going to be, where is it going to be an ethical business to go into the human population and start saying, okay, here's your genetic test, therefore this is what you should eat, or here's what you should do to try to reduce your problems for chronic diseases. That line is going to be very hard for those of us who are in the business to know when to cross. Right now it's clearly too early to make that jump.
All right, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank all my guests. Jim Caput, who's Senior Molecular Biologist at the Center of Excellence in Nutritional Genomics, UC Davis, and Founder, President, and Chief Scientific Officer of NutriGenomics, based in Chicago. Raymond Rodriguez, Professor of Molecular and Cellular Biology, Universities, California, Davis, same place, and Director of University Center of Excellence in Nutritional Genomics. And Mary Nessel, Professor and Chair of the Department of Nutrition and Food Studies at NYU here in New York, author of Food Politics and Safe Food, both published by University of California Press. Thank you both for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Arrigo Cardi in New York. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from Kim Molesky and Alphonse Finn. I'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.